5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to the fastest 2 hours in radio right here at Yahoo Sports Radio right here in beautiful Houston, Texas. Remember to listen to the show on the go. Just download the Yahoo Sports Radio app by searching Yahoo Sports Radio in your app store. You can also listen on any computer or smart device by going to streamysr.com. That's streamysr.com. And remember, normal data rates apply. So the countdown is on for opening day of baseball. We're going to be talking all about that here in hour number two. We're going to celebrate right now a bit of a history lesson. Because it's been a while since the author and baseball historian Brian Ross has been with us on our show. Of course, last year he released his book, Baseball's Greatest Comeback, The Miracle Braves of 1914. Of course, Brian is joining us on our Progressive Insurance Celebrity Guest Line. Good evening. It's so nice to have you back, Brian.
Well, thanks, Alyssa. It's great to be back.
Okay, so spring training, it is underway, and we have, over the past few weeks, we've been showcasing each week several teams. We've invited you back on to share about your book and several other things, storylines that are going on in spring training, but just kind of give us a recap of baseball's greatest comeback, the Miracle Braves of 1914, because the one thing I do remember, it is about a team that battles through adversity and winning, and they never gave up.
That's right. That's right. It's a great worst the first story. The Boston Braves start off after they're, like so many teams this year in spring training, they were hopeful in their spring training of 1914, over 100 years ago, and the season started, however, and they were abysmal. They just lost game after game after game. They figured out every possible way to lose a game. Their pitching was poor, their hitting was poor, and by mid-July, they were 15 games out of first place, and they had been woeful for years before this, too, so it did not look good for the 1914 Braves, but they started to battle back. They had great pitching. They eventually had two pitchers who won 26 games. Their hitting started to pick up. They came together under the leadership of this manager, George Stallings, who's brilliant, who started to platoon that summer. He figured out platooning for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had this understanding of baseball analytics over 100 years ago. And he was quite a character, too, by the way. He was extremely superstitious, banning the color yellow and carrying amulets and just 100 other superstitious practices that he had. But he led the team, and they had a number of great characters, and they start to win, and they catch up to the New York Giants at the time, who were this team led by John McGraw. They were a great team, but they win the pennant, and then they have to go up against the Philadelphia A's, a great dynasty. They had won 3 out of the last 4 World Series, and the Braves end up beating them. So they go from 15 games out of first place. Mathematically, it's just this great, great comeback, too, if you just looked at the math of it all. But it was, they had heart, and they had determination. They had so much grit. Their captain, Johnny Evers, their famous Evers of Evers to Tinkers to Chance, the double play, he was just a great, determined player, and he led the team on the field. He was the captain of the team. So it's just a great story.
Author Brian Ross, a baseball historian, is joining us at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. His book, Baseball's Greatest Comeback, The Miracle Braves of 1940. It truly is one of baseball's greatest comebacks, a joyous baseball season of the Miracle Braves. How would you rank this in terms of, you just think about the history in baseball as far as a team coming back? I mean, they were down, but they were never out.
Yeah. I mean, I got right up there. I've looked at the 1951 Giants, who had a great comeback that year, too, and the Mets, 69, they also had a great comeback. But the Braves were just so great because, for a number of reasons, too. I mean, I've mentioned, but also they're playing in Boston that year with the Boston Red Sox. And the Boston Red Sox had won the World Series in 1912, and they had this great new baseball park, Fenway Park. And the Braves had this little tiny bandbox and not much of anything. So the Braves, in contrast to the Red Sox, were not much of a team at all. And then also, 1914 is the year when World War One begins. So it's starting that same summer, and the Americans are reading the newspaper, and they're reading about the Germans going into Belgium. They're aware of the number of deaths. And so they contrast this beautiful baseball season with the horrors that are going on in Europe at the same time. So that even, I think, adds to the whole idea of this comeback, too. It just shows this team doing something exceptional in a troubled time.
You know, one of the things I wanted you to share as well is a special era in baseball, not just because of Babe, but also so many iconic players that the game would know, like, you know, Cy Young and Ty Cobb.
Yeah, that's true. And 1914 is pretty interesting to me because it happened to be the rookie year for Babe Ruth. Mm-hmm. And the Red Sox bring him in the summer of 1914, and they actually ended up sending Babe Ruth down. That's how good the Red Sox were in 1914. But yeah, the Braves have to battle all these top players. The person that I think the most of in baseball in this time period is Connie Mack, and he is the manager of the Philadelphia A's at the time, and he's doing so much for baseball, and he's managing this great team, number one. But he's also bringing it. He's making baseball more civilized. He's making it more fan friendly. I think baseball in the 1890s had been a very rough, tough sport, and all kinds of brawling and drinking going on. And I think Connie Mack did a lot to civilize and just make baseball, bring it into the modern era also.
We're being reflective. We're talking about baseball's greatest comeback, the Miracle Braves of 1914, with author and baseball historian Brian Ross. And, you know, we think of so many great teams that were vying for the World Series title, the New York Giants, whether the Boston Red Sox, Philadelphia Athletics. Nobody saw the Boston Braves coming. How were these guys able to fight back and transform this into a miracle season?
Yeah, well, there were a number of things. First of all, the great pitching. They developed the second half of the year. They had two guys who could throw the stick ball exceptionally well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something a little bit different from nowadays. But they understood that. Then George Stallings, the manager I was talking about before, who was this exceptional guy who's kept he was so superstitious on the one hand, but this brilliant mathematical mind on the other. And he was also he knew how to handle players too. I think he was the kind of guy who knew when to be tough. He knew when to be supportive, and the players liked him, but they feared him too. And I think he brought the team together. And then they had Johnny Evers, who I mentioned before, the captain, who he was one of the smartest baseball players ever. He would study the rule book every night. He probably knew the rule book better than most of the umpires. Which got him in trouble some of the time too, because he was very assertive and he would point out when the umpires were wrong. But he became the MVP at the end of the year. He was that good, even though he went through this trauma in the middle of the baseball season. His 3-year-old daughter died, and that's another reason this season is a comeback of sorts, because this guy had to go from despair to, but he finally goes back to the team and they're able to win the World Series. And then they had another character on the team named Robert Mirandel, who's also in the Hall of Fame. He was the shortstop. He was the prankster of the team, and he would have glasses in his back pocket, and if the umpire made a bad call, he put the glasses on the umpire. I mean, he was constantly doing something like that. So they had the right blend of players too.
Opening day for baseball, it is just around the corner. We're celebrating, getting ready for the big season ahead, going one-on-one with Brian Ross, author and baseball historian, talking about his book, Baseball's Greatest Comeback, The Miracle Braves. We've got to step aside for a commercial break, and when we're rejoined, we've got much, much more to get into. We're going to talk some spring training with Brian Ross right here at YSR, the Big E Sports Show, and join us online at Twitter, at @eRadioSports. We will be right back. Welcome back to Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am Elissa Walker-Campbell. As always, an open invitation. We'd love to hear from you. Join us at Twitter at @eRadioSports, and also head over to our network. We've got so many amazing hosts here right here at yahoosportsradio.com/podcast, and you can listen to so many of the shows. And remember, always listen to the show on the go. Download the Yahoo Sports Radio app. Well, right now we're going one-on-one with Brian Ross. He's an author, baseball historian. In the first segment, we're talking about baseball's greatest comeback, the Miracle Braves of 1914. A little bit of a history lesson. Let's continue with that, Brian. Talk to me about when spring training. When did that get underway?
Well, that goes back a long time. Just after the Civil War, Boss Tweed, the mayor of New York, who ran it with an iron fist, he had his own baseball team, and he brings the New York Mutuals down to New Orleans. Then it started to take off in the 1880s, and especially the 1890s, during the small ball era, their dead ball era, as it was called, and there was. The teams realized that they needed to sharpen their skills, the sacrifice bunt, the stealing, hit and run, all big parts of the dead ball era. You could improve on those if you had spring training, and the team starts to realize, like the Baltimore Orioles, well, let's practice some more in the spring, and then we'll win a championship, and it turned out to be true, so they start doing it. 1890s, early 1900s, but it's spread out all across the southern part of the country. I mean, and it changed from year to year where teams would go, and it was somewhat unscheduled. I mean, by our standards today, it was pretty chaotic, but by the 1920s, it's going to settle down in Florida. The Citrus League will really be established in the 1920s.
How did World War II, how did that affect spring training?
Yeah. World War II really changed baseball in so many ways. I mean, first of all, we thought that we might not play baseball during the war, but then Franklin Roosevelt decided, yeah, we got to keep our national pastime going. So he gave what was called the famous green light letter. But so many players went and played in so many players were drafted, they had to get a lot of AA players to come up and a lot of older players. But spring training really didn't exist. And the way it had, because there was the scarcity of fuel, and fuel was being rationed, and the government decided to only give baseball teams a certain amount of fuel, or allow them a certain amount of fuel, so they couldn't go far. They couldn't go down south. They couldn't travel. So they stayed near their cities, and they practiced in YMCAs. They practiced at college fields. So they did not have, during the war, they did not have spring training as we know it. But spring training really takes a different course after the war. That's when, you know, it's 1947 when Jackie Robinson breaks the color barrier.
Right, so right.
That had a big influence on how spring training was conducted.
I was going to say, how much did that change when Jackie Robinson broke that color barrier?
Yeah, well, it changed and it didn't. On the one hand, of course, African-American players are going to be going down to Florida to practice with the teams. And so if you've seen the movie 42, and if you've seen the opening, one of the earlier scenes when Jackie Robinson goes down for one of the first spring trainings in Florida, and he's with the Dodgers minor league team, the Royals, and he faces taunting. He cannot stay in the same hotel with the other players, and he has to go through all of these struggles. Just horrible. And that is what it was like for most of the African-American players for a long time. That's the one thing that struck me when I looked back at the historical record, that even though Major League Baseball was integrated from 1947 on, it's not until 1964 that spring training is integrated. It takes a long time for this to happen. So you have all of these well-known baseball players, you know, the Cardinals, Kirk Flood and Bill White and Bob Gibson. They're living in segregated hotels, and then starting to complain about it and starting their own civil rights movement of sorts. So it took a lot to change things in Florida in the 50s and 60s.
Author and baseball historian, and his book is Baseball's Greatest Comeback, The Miracle Braves of 1914. Brian Ross is joining us at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. Only have time for a few more questions. Since we're on the topic of spring training, what was the economic impact of having spring training?
Yeah, that is a fascinating question. I think it seems to me that it's generally favorable in that towns and cities throughout Arizona and Florida get the benefit of having their name publicized and associated with a major league team. But there's a guy named Philip Porter, an economist, who studied teams in Florida, and he studied, he'll look, for instance, a team in a certain town, they might move out of the town. He'll look at sales tax revenue when the team was there and when they left. And he has found that the sales tax revenue stays the same. So, in other words, the team is not having a big economic impact. That people would go to Florida and Arizona anyway and spend money, and so that maybe baseball is not attracting as much as politicians claim. Now, every politician in Florida and Arizona will say, yeah, this is great. This is really going to bring money to the town. But economists debate it highly. They have all kinds of data saying, well, maybe not. But it's all great fun, and that's an important thing for me.
I'm curious, what about as far as spring training, how it developed in the 70s and 80s?
One of the things about spring training is that it's in constant turmoil. I mean, it's in the 70s. It took a while for it to be established so that there were 15 teams in Arizona and 15 in Florida. That really took a long time, and even as late as the 1980s, we weren't sure if they were going to be all in Arizona. In Arizona, there were some political difficulties, and the state canceled the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, and that caused some consternation. But eventually, things changed in Arizona, and they passed a tax for to use revenue from car rentals to pay for stadiums, and they've done the same thing in Florida. But there's so many communities out there that would love to have a baseball team that I think is going to be in turmoil in the future even. In the late 1990s, there was a really strong interest among seven baseball teams to move to Las Vegas even, to start the Oasis League. They were unsure if they could get public money for stadia in Florida, and they were thinking of moving to Las Vegas, and I think that's always a possibility too. So it's not quite the same stability that there is in the 30 major league teams right now.
Hey, Brian Ross has been with us tonight at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. Author, baseball historian, of course, his book, Baseball's Greatest Comeback, The Miracle Braves of 1940. We're going to be talking some more MLB. Up next is Andy Pondillo as we get ready for an AL East preview. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Brian.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, Alyssa.
Okay, stay close. Much more straight ahead as we continue to go around the horn. Welcome back to Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show, as we continue with hour number two. We're going around the horn and getting you set and ready. Opening day. Gosh, it is just around the corner. So once again, we have invited back in studio our producer right here at YSR. That, of course, is Andy Pondillo. I know it's March Madness, but we're carving out time to talk about your favorite sport. It's good to have you back.
Oh, yeah, I put no effort into March Madness. I find a bracket from an expert that knows what he's talking about. I steal it, and then I hope to win the challenge. Last year, I got second place. This year, maybe not so lucky.
Ah, so let me ask you. I'm going to put you on the spot, Andy P. We're here in the South region. Who is going to win it all?
Well, I put Duke on there just because that's what the expert told me to, and also because when you play these bracket challenges versus everybody in the office, everybody's going to pick Kentucky, so the only way you're going to win is through the earlier rounds. So why not roll the dice, pick a different champion, and if you hit, then you'll probably win the championship.
Well, one of the teams that's going to be rolling the dice, of course, this year is the Baltimore Orioles. Let's head out to and start things off in the AL East. Of course, 96-66. That's how they finished in 2014. What is your predictions on how this team will do?
This team is hard for me to predict because last year I was saying the whole year this team's overrated. They're going to collapse down the second half. Chris Tillman's having a mirage of a year. Bud Norris isn't that great. Wei-Yu Chen, I don't know if he can keep it up. This pitching staff just didn't really impress me. The thing they kept doing is their pitching was good enough, and their hitting stayed very consistent through the season. Even without Matt Wieters most of the year, they still found ways to score runs, and a lot of that came from Nelson Cruz. They did lose some offense, but they do get some back with Machado coming back from the disabled list. Wieters will come back at some point during the regular season. These two will definitely help the lineup, but losing Nelson Cruz, a huge bat. Can Chris Davis duplicate what he did a couple years ago? And that starting rotation still makes me scratch my head and wonder how they won this many games. What they do have going for them is I don't think anybody's dominant in the American League East. There's good teams in this division, but all of them have some gaping holes. So that can, you know, lead you to win some games, whether it's slugging the ball, whether it's winning some sloppy games, whether it's these pitchers, they don't have to do as much as maybe they would have to do in a division like the National League West. So I think they're competitive. They still just seem blah to me, though.
Well, when you look at the 40-man roster, let's talk about things defensively. I mean, what kind of depth do they have in terms of their outfield?
Well, Adam Jones is a gold glover out there and a guy that can swing the bat. So he's going to have to lead the charge. Without the power that they had from Markakis, without Nelson Cruz, who was mainly a DH, but losing that from the outfield definitely hurts. Steve Pierce was a bit of a mirage last year, a utility guy, a career guy that's played on the bench. It looks like, I believe they're going to start him and see what he can do this year. He had a strong season last year, but do you expect him to do that again? We see this a lot in baseball where guys just come out of nowhere, have one big year, then they go right back to what they were most of their career. I like to look at guys in terms of 3 and 4 years to get a package of what to expect from them and find some type of median. You know, I don't know if he can duplicate that. So the outfield depth, it's not the best in the division. But with Adam Jones out there, he gives you gold glove defense. He's going to give you a top five bat in the American League. And, you know, that's quite a lot. A lot of teams would love to have that.
Andy, talk to me about Dan Duquette. He obviously has been a hot commodity and a little bit of a saga going on there.
Well, there's always drama with the Orioles, and that comes from their ownership group and then goes down to Duquette. So I don't know if he's going to stay there long term. There's that Blue Jays thing that was going on. Definitely had his days with the Red Sox. So we'll see what happens. I think he's done a good job over there in Baltimore. They don't really just open up the pocketbooks for him, but he's made some good trades. The trade he did with the Astros to get Bud Norris proved to be a very beneficial deal for the Orioles. Not so much getting that ace starter, but adding depth to a starting rotation that not necessarily is dominant, but it has shown that they're deep and that every arm in that rotation can at least give you a quality outing and can give you a chance to win. It may not be the chance of one run over eight innings all the time, but it gets, you know, 3 or 4 runs. With that offense, that's all you got to do.
Okay, we're talking about drama. First baseman Chris Davis, he completes his 25-game suspension after his unauthorized use of Adderall on opening day. Talk to me about Davis.
Well, Davis, he's an interesting guy in that last year, the power numbers were good. A run production wasn't horrible, but his batting average fell off the map. And he kind of looked like Chris Davis that we saw at the Texas Rangers that couldn't hold a starting position. It was up and down from AAA, and then eventually the Rangers gave up on him. And then he moved to the Orioles, had that big year 2 years ago. I don't think he has a year like that again, but if he can go somewhere in between the numbers of the last 2 years, stay off the Adderall or get a prescription for it or whatever is necessary so he doesn't get suspended, that will definitely help because his bat, regardless of his struggles last year, his bat was dearly missed in postseason play. When the Royals all of a sudden started hitting for power, that American League Championship Series, they sure could have used Chris Davis's bat to offset that power, and maybe he bops a couple out himself. So he's going to be huge in the middle of that order. Without Nelson Cruz, that's a gaping hole in the middle of the order, and you have to expect Chris Davis is the only guy that can pick up that production, not only for himself, but to also protect Adam Jones. Adam Jones doesn't have the year he had last year if he doesn't have Nelson Cruz protecting him in the lineup.
Okay, so here's a question. When we talk about Davis, do you think that perhaps he was a one-year wonder? We look at his numbers and what he was able to produce in 2013. I mean, he led the majors in home runs with 53.
I don't think he's a one-year wonder because I've been watching him since he's with the Rangers, belting home runs against the Astros 420 feet. So I know it's there. And he found it for that one season and put it all together. I think the power is always going to be there for Chris. The more question is, can he put the bat on the ball enough to stay in a major league lineup to be a productive major league hitter? There's a lot of guys, I think, that could hit 25 home runs in the major leagues and end up in AAA just because that's all they do. You know, what good is 20-something home runs if you're only batting 190, if you're only getting on base at a 285 clip? You've got to do more once you get to Major League Baseball. A lot of these lines, they want you to be able to play defense. They want you to be able to get on base. You've got to show more tools than just one tool. And that's going to be the question for Chris. The power is always going to be there. As long as he's healthy, he'll hit over 20 home runs every year in his career in the major leagues. It's the other stuff that I question. He's got to be able to get on base at a higher clip. He's got to be able to hit the ball, put the bat on the ball at a little bit higher clip. And a lot of that just comes to pitch selection. There are times where he's waving at pitches he shouldn't be. There's times where he's trying to drive the ball where maybe he needs a better two-strike approach.
Okay, one more quick question about the Baltimore Orioles. Buck Showalter, in his fifth year, talk to us about his leadership as a manager.
Buck Showalter is perfect for this team because this is a quirky team in general. Probably not a team that should win 96 games last year, but they found a way. Buck deserves manager of the year almost every time he puts his team in contention because that's just a tough division to win in. The Red Sox are always going to reload every time they're down. The Yankees, I don't know what they're doing, but they're always trying to reload regardless. The Rays have dominant pitching year in and year out. It's hard to compete in that division if you're the Orioles or the Blue Jays, but yet the Orioles have found a way to break through two of the last three seasons. Buck's been a huge part of that. They've assembled some decent talent over there. They could make a move or two to really improve this team, but if they don't, he seems like he always finds a way to win with what he's got.
That is the spring synopsis on the Baltimore Orioles. Let's move on over. You just mentioned the Boston Red Sox. Beautiful segue. Okay, so in 2014, they finished 71-91, fifth in the AL East. That is not good enough. They underachieved. What needs to happen so that they can move in more into the win column?
Well, this is a different team. If there's one team that's completely changed the face of their roster, it's been the Red Sox. And it's amazing. 2 years ago, they're winning a World Series. 2 years later, the entire starting pitching is different besides Clay Buchholz. I think it could work. I think this team could compete very well in the American League East. I don't know if they have the correct team to make a playoff run because their pitching just doesn't have enough dominance up front. However, we know the Red Sox will make moves. And I know this team's got to be able to score runs. A Dustin Pedroia, Victorino at the top of the order, Mookie Betts, I know they're excited about, Big Poppy, Hanley, Pablo Sandoval. This team is just stacked. You could have Mike Napoli batting seventh in this lineup. This lineup, in my opinion, is the most complete lineup in all of baseball. It much reminds me of the 2013 lineup in which the Red Sox won the World Series with. It's not the power that necessarily wins. It's a good mix. It's the difference of hitters. You like to have a lineup that has a guy with speed. You like to have a lineup that has a guy that can get on base, contact, you know, guys that switch hit, lefty-righty. It makes it a disadvantage for matchups. This lineup has everything you could ask for. If it stays healthy, they're going to score a lot of runs. Will the pitching be enough? And that's the biggest question for this team.
You are spot on, because what is the rotation without John Lester? I mean, they don't have a true number one guy.
They definitely don't. And Rick Porcello, Wade Miley, Joe Kelly, you know, these guys all coming over looking to prove themselves. And a lot of quality arms still in this rotation. The Cespedes deal, getting Porcello, a guy that was sometimes forgotten about over with the Tigers when he had a Price, a Verlander, or a Scherzer. But he could be just as good as a lot of these pitchers out there, in my opinion, could be a true number two in a rotation. They lack the number one. And if the Red Sox, we know them well enough, they'll do something big once the trade deadline comes up if they need to. Kind of surprised Lester didn't come back to the Red Sox. I kind of had a feeling with them reloading this team that he would be in a position to come be their number one, but perhaps he was a bit insulted by some low value, some low contract negotiations at the beginning, so he took his talents to Chicago.
You know, I thought it was interesting, too. You and I had a chance to talk earlier. You said that Boston wins the division, but not a strong playoff team unless moves are made. What kind of moves are you looking for, Andy?
They have to improve the starting pitching at the top. The closer position, Uehara, a couple years ago, was dominant. Last year, he kind of fell apart towards the end of the year. I kind of wonder what he's going to do. That's a position they may look at bolstering. Maybe not the closer, but just bolstering the late inning relief. Edward Mojica was definitely good for them as well. But I think the starting rotation is definitely what they have to improve. It's really the only hole on this team that's gaping, and it's good. I'm not saying this is a bad rotation. This rotation could be above league average if everything works out. It's just when you get in the postseason play, you need more than depth. You need dominance out of those front two, and that's something that the Giants have been able to ride for years. They've rode three World Series titles from having dominant front ends to their rotation. The depth is important, but the dominance of having a Madison Bumgarner, you know, having a John Lester when the Red Sox were able to win those, I think that's even more important sometimes than any other element on a team. So if you don't have that dominant number one, it's going to be hard for me to predict you to win a World Series.
Okay, we are talking about the AL East we just hit on, the Baltimore Orioles and the Boston Red Sox, with our very own Andy Pondillo, our baseball guy. And after the commercial break, we will continue in the AL East, and this time we will shine a spotlight on the Toronto Blue Jays. Much more coming your way right here at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Always love to hear from you. Join us at Twitter at eRadio Sports. We will be right back. Our opening day preview continues right here at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am Elissa Walker-Campbell, taking you through hour number two as we continue to go one-on-one with Andy Pondillo right here at YSR. And before we get too far into the interview, Andy, tell the listeners where they can check you out online.
Yeah, let's talk in Astros baseball at climbingtowelshill.com. The podcast is Astro Chat.
Okay, we're going to keep it right here. We've been talking AL East. Let's get some highlights from the Toronto Blue Jays. What are some of those notable spring storylines that we're looking after?
Well, with the Blue Jays, it seems like for the last decade, they always can hit, but can they pitch? And because they can't pitch is why they don't make any playoff appearances. I believe the longest playoff drought in Major League Baseball now since the Pirates and Royals ended their strings. So this team, Josh Donaldson coming in, they're going to have Jose Bautista back, Edwin Encarnacion, Jose Reyes. There's some names on this lineup. It's definitely a top-heavy lineup. They're definitely going to score runs. I don't think their order is as good as the Red Sox, but I think they can hit more home runs than the Red Sox. So that's going to keep them at least relevant. Mark Burley, R.A. Dickey, those are the guys they're going to depend on at the front of that rotation. That would scare me. Burley had a great year last year, an all-star caliber season, but you start relying on these old guys to be at the front of your rotation. That's scary.
Okay, so Andy, how will Josh Donaldson, how do you see him fitting in? I mean, he's been an elite two-way player, finishing fourth and eighth in the MVP voting over the last 2 years.
I think he could put up MVP numbers once again this year, batting in this lineup. I kind of wondered, when I first saw Josh Donaldson come up 2 years ago and make some headlines, wonder if this guy's just a flash in the pan. He has a high leg kick, kind of a whippy swing. He played great defense. I knew that was there, but I didn't know if I was going to expect that he was going to continue to do what he was doing. But he proved me wrong last year. He was productive, and I think that he's going to benefit from batting in this batting order. You know, do you bat him second in front of Bautista? Do you want to bat him fourth behind him? Do you put him in between Bautista and Encarnacion? It's going to be a lot of decisions to make, but you really can't go wrong with any of them. He's going to really benefit from batting in this order and also playing in a nice hitter-friendly ballpark in Toronto. You know, you don't think of Toronto as a launching pad. You don't think of it as a Coors Field or a Texas ballpark in Arlington, but it's definitely a good place to hit. You don't have to worry about the climate over there with the retractable roof. It's nice and dim inside, a good batter's eye. So I think you'll see his power numbers increase while he's there.
Talking about the Toronto Blue Jays, of course, last year in 2014, 83-79, third in the AL East. One of the things I always like to ask you about is in terms of leadership. And the manager, John Gibbons, he's in his third year. What do you think about the job that he's done?
You know, John Gibbons is an intense guy. I think he's done good for that team. He's gotten them relevant. He's kept them in the race. They definitely faded away last year. And you know that a lot of times we talk about managers, we want to blame them or grade them by their wins and losses. Do they take an okay team to postseason play? Do they make a really good team not as good as they should be? When I look at the Blue Jays, I always look at their pitching staff. It's so hard to win in this league if you're not giving true depth at the top of the rotation, and the Blue Jays don't have that. So it's going to be difficult. Their big move was to sign R.A. Dickey a couple years ago. That really hasn't worked out for them. They're not getting the value that they placed in him, but I think a lot of people saw that coming, an old knuckleballer that won a Cy Young for the Mets. It was hard to predict that he was going to keep up those numbers. I think money could have been spent better from the Blue Jays front office, but with that, he's done a good job at the manager's helm.
Okay, we hit on the Blue Jays. Let's head south. Talking about managers, the first year for Kevin Cash. What are your expectations for the Tampa Bay Rays?
Who knows with the Tampa Bay Rays? Another team that just is reluctant to spend money when it's necessary. This team has had so much talent on it that it's sickening that you have a Ben Zobrist, an Evan Longoria, Will Myers, David Price, Matt Moore, Alex Cobb. this is like the farm system for Major League Baseball now, is to, you know, get your feet wet with the Rays and then go make some money somewhere else. The team is still somehow relevant, though, no matter how many trades they make. The rotation looks good. Matt Moore coming back from injury. You expect him maybe around June. You have Chris Archer, who's going to start up the opening day for the Rays, definitely a young, talented pitcher. Drew Smyly acquired from the Tigers. Alex Cobb. The big question for them is going to be the middle of the order, and how are they going to produce runs? James Loney probably going to be the cleanup guy. Longoria. It's going to take some nifty managing from Kevin Cash, and Joe Maddon was able to do that. He was able to take all these random pieces he was given offensively, and he was able to construct them somehow to get the most out of them. No matter how bad this offense looked at times, he was always able to get them over to hump. So Kevin Cash, he's got some big shoes to fill after Maddon leaving. I don't know if this team is playoff bound, but I would at least imagine that they're competitive with the starting rotation to run out there.
And I thought it was interesting, too, that the Rays are so different than any of the other teams in the East, but is anybody really good on this roster?
Longoria. I mean, Evan Longoria is an MVP candidate if he ever puts his season back together, a full healthy year. And they've been talking about that for how many years now? If we just get Longoria healthy, you know, even when he's not on the disabled list or not out of the lineup, it seems like he's always dinged up with something. This guy has as much potential at the third base position as any guy in Major League Baseball. He and Donaldson should be the top two. And in fact, I think he's got a much better plate approach than Donaldson, but Josh Donaldson stays healthy, and that's the difference. So can Longoria put up those numbers again? I don't know. It's going to be difficult when he doesn't have protection in the back end of that order. He didn't always, he's never really had a ton, but when he batted around Ben Zobrist, he was a nice attribute to that lineup. James Loney's been good for them. It's just going to be a very thin order.
Andy Bondillo with us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Let's transition now. Let's talk about the Yankees. Are they going to be better off without Derek Jeter?
Well, Didi Gregorius definitely will probably be better immediately just because it gives you some fresh legs out there. He can run. He's young. He's fun. He probably put him at the top of the order. As for losing the captain, I can't imagine it helps the clubhouse and this team all banged up as much as it is constantly. I do not expect the Yankees to have a very good year. Tanaka may be the only thing that's fun on that team.
So what's gonna have to happen in order for them to become World Series contenders again?
I think they got to blow the whole team up, but the Steinbrenners won't do that. You know, they want to compete now. New York wants to have them always compete now. So it's just not in the cards for the Yankees to do that. They have so many bad contracts, Teixeira, Sabathia, A-Rod. You know, eventually they're going to get these guys off the books, and when they do, it might give them a chance. But before that, I think they need to launch a preemptive strike. I don't feel like they're doing that this year, but at some point, I'll just blow this whole thing up. Trade McCann, get anything you can for him. Maybe trade Tanaka, get anything you can for him, you know, and just rebuild this thing from scratch with your farm system, with savvy moves. They won't do it, but I think that's what I would do because long term, this team's in bad shape.
Okay, opening day. It is coming up. The countdown is on, and it's such a pleasure always, each and every week, to be joined by Andy Pondillo right here at Yahoo Sports Radio. Great job, Andy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
A very special thank you to all of our amazing guests on our lineup. Of course, that was Andy Pondillo at YSR. We also want to say a special thank you to Brian Ross, author of Baseball's Greatest Comeback, Lee Klein from Slam Magazine, Tim Scott with Ben Hogan's book, The Myths Everyone Knows, The Minute No One Knew, and Nancy Lieberman, Hall of Famer, pre- and post-game analyst for the Oklahoma City Thunder. Enjoy all the games. Remember, don't drink and drive. We'll see you next weekend for the biggest, the best in sports right here at Yahoo Sports Radio and yahoosportsradio.com.